stories will be all that AI leaves us with. Our stories, our adventures, our experiences. And we will truly be able to have a life where we make entirely our own meaning of it. We tell our own story, and we are liberated from the basic toils that we used to. And so it will be a scary thing to truly have to light our own path and light our own way in a way that as a society we've not had to do before. I think this is what we are meant to be and what we are meant to do, and we can continue to expand our frontier.
Hi, and welcome back to the Blue Morpho podcast. I'm your host, Hamilton Souther. And today we have Kyle Gray with us on the podcast. And this is exciting for me because I've had a few amazing conversations with Kyle, and he's an expert in the world of storytelling. And I'm really interested in getting into that in this conversation today. So Kyle, I just want to welcome you to the show, and thank you so much for being here with us.
Hamilton, it is such an honor. I too have been energized and just inspired by our conversations, and I'm so excited to have another opportunity for it here and to get to share some stories and some useful strategies to create stories with everybody listening today.
Yeah, you know, storytelling's become more and more important for me over the years, and so I wanted to hear from you. Why do you think that storytelling is so important for humans and what it gives them?
I think that storytelling is probably the most foundational technology, even before fire. It was a simple way for us to get ideas across to one another. And in a lot of ways, to be able to transfer knowledge like that, I think was one of our biggest advantages very early on as a species. And so there's something so fundamental to this. And the more that you study it and see the patterns and see how it interacts with our brain, we as humans grew up with storytelling, and it allowed us to build our civilization, build ourselves, and continue to innovate in so many fantastic ways that we very rarely can anticipate. And so with it being such a fundamental core thing that makes us human, now in this age where so many of those things are coming into question in one form or another, the way we're distributed information, knowledge, entertainment is triggering a lot of these same primal things, but in the same way that sugar triggers our primal senses. And so we're just getting blasted with all kinds of information. Every answer to any question you could ever want is online right now. And I sometimes find myself wondering, when I put in a Google search, I really need to be careful how I ask this question, because being aware of the intent of the other side of this process, this algorithm. And so while there's so much that is starting to degrade or come into question, the thing that's most valuable now in this world of information, in this world of knowledge, in this world of everybody has a solution for their 8-pack abs, people want wisdom and connection. We want somebody with insight that can distill this vast sea of knowledge into a package that makes sense to us, that relates to us. And there's nothing more effective at doing that than telling a good story. And what makes up a good story, there's a lot that goes into that. And it's not just recounting something that happened to you in the past. There's a lot more to it than that. But when we can start to do this, especially in this age, I think this is what people are hungry for. This is what buyers want to feel from somebody who's making them an offer. This is what listeners want to hear from speakers and podcasters and social media leaders. We want to connect with you as a human. And if we can't do that, then it doesn't matter how good your thing is, how smart your knowledge is, or how many certifications you have. It will go in one ear and out the other. So this is the first step and the first bridge to all the rest of your expertise and serving people the way that you want to.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm really interested in going into this idea of the two sides of this algorithm and the that you mentioned searching something and then understanding that there's another side of it. From your experience, what is that other side? How does that information ultimately get translated to you as a person, you know, searching and looking for information?
A few years back, as a blogging hobby, I started writing a series called The Defense Against the Dark Arts of the Internet. And as somebody who studied marketing for over a decade now, and persuasion and getting people to buy, it becomes very easy to see this. I'm sure I've done a little bit of my fair share of working these same magics, but I guess it takes a thief to see a thief. And though when I do a lot of my work, I want to help and serve the right people, but that's not necessarily what everybody else is doing. And so when I put into a search in Google, I know that most of the people that want to be on the other end of that search, I've thought about this, I want to find the right words for the person who has buying intent. And if as long as they have that intent, I want to frame my answer as the answer to their problem. And so it's that not necessarily a game of getting them the best information or really what's most relevant to them. On the surface, it kind of is and wants to look like that. But it's really much more this competitive bidding war of how can I get my answer to fit this specific search. And so that's what I mean by every answer. When I type in a search looking for something, especially how you search will determine the answers that you find. And they will try to affirm you or influence you in certain ways. And so being aware of that, I want to be really careful to find just the right Google search that's not going to ultimately try to lead me to buy something or to think something or to influence me in a certain kind of way. And I don't necessarily know how we could do a better job with search engine optimization, but into really being a service for humans instead of a competitive business sport. But it makes it harder to do your Google searches when you start to think like this. Maybe it's useful, but there you always want to be aware of the tremendous amount of money that's being invested to influence you in one way or another. A random aside, but like I still remember the Juicy Fruit gum jingle, and that bothers me sometimes, you know. What else has
I think if you can think of any brand where the brand went was in your neural network. If you can remember any logo where it went was the neural network, and then you got to ask why. I think it's really fascinating that you mention magic and you mentioned dark arts, because I came in contact directly with those words when I came down to Peru and got into ayahuasca shamanism and found out that ayahuasca shamanism wasn't only about the beautiful aspects of healing and spirituality, but there were these other sides to it too that had great warnings down here about it. And it didn't make any sense to me. I didn't have a way to compare, like, well, what is this in our psyche, or why would people be interested in that in the first place? And then as I came in contact with it more and dealt with it more, I started to realize from my side, oh, that is what marketing is. Oh, that is what's going on in the Western world. The Western world was like, oh, those things don't exist anymore. And I was like, don't exist. It's proliferated. And so I think it's really interesting that you use those terms. How did you come to think about it in terms of a kind of magic or dark arts?
That's a great question. And I feel that over the course of the last decade, I've slowly been coming to terms that I am a wizard and a magician myself. And I have seen the light side and the dark side of this played out in incredible ways in my work and in my life. And I've, for my whole life, especially since 19 or so, I've been obsessed with language in one form or another. I spent a lot of my early 20s traveling in South America. I lived in Peru, Colombia, Brazil, Chile, Argentina. I've learned to speak Spanish and Portuguese, and I've had this conversation with other polyglots before, but learning languages started to show me the seams of reality in a certain way. And what I mean by that is there's words in Portuguese that English can't we have to talk around it to get to it. It's a couple of sentences, but they can feel it in one word. And until I really started to understand and feel that word in that language, it was kind of like a new flavor of ice cream. It was a new experience that I really didn't have before. And the way we structure our language. In English, I knock the cup off the table. In Spanish, the cup knocks itself off the table. And that may seem, it seems like a minor syntactical kind of frustrating thing when you're in basic grammar trying to learn how to speak properly. But this also fundamentally shapes how you see your reality. And when you start to see, oh, it can be constructed this way, it can be constructed that way, then all of a sudden, you start to learn where something didn't seem to be malleable or plastic, movable, changeable, because it was almost invisible to you. Another good example, though not language, I spent a lot of time in Thailand as well. And in Thailand, they use their forks and spoons differently than we do in the West. They kind of use their fork to push food onto their spoon. And in the West, we like to stab things. But I've never thought of this. And now I have access to this. And it's like there was a knob where there wasn't one before. So bringing this all back to language and magic, the words that we choose to use are so powerful in shaping our reality and our circumstances. And we are telling ourselves stories all the time. The same stories that influence us, or that can be used from the stage to connect with an audience, are the same things that we are telling ourselves at night right before we go to bed and are keeping us from doing what we really want to be doing, or in that relationship that we don't want to be in, or whatever number of things out there. And so this magic is, I believe, the ever-present foundation of the world that we live in. And it's been such a wonderful gift to naturally, accidentally continue to find myself digging deeper and deeper into, how do I communicate with different people in different languages? How do I tell a story that creates a connection and wants people to listen, or makes somebody interested in buying something, or overcomes their objections, or helps them embody the identity that they know that they are, but just haven't quite been able to articulate it yet? In the same way that a word in Portuguese, I can't feel it until I really understand it. When you can really articulate your own story with that level of clarity in a way that it changes how you show up as a leader. And it creates that energy that we really look for and want in our leaders, and that you really want to embody to get you out the door to do the incredibly challenging things that you are so excited to do. I think the best place to start in that is starting to understand certain forms of language. And I'm going to reference somebody who taught me this, and our mutual friend Ryan Sprague taught us both this. Mark England developed the enlifted method, which classifies a few different kinds of language. And once we become aware of these things, we can start to see the pieces and the knobs in an interesting way. So there's two categories. There's conflict language and architect language. The big picture is we want to speak more architect language. Conflict language has three subcategories. Ones are negations. Don't think of a blue elephant. I don't want to do this. This should not happen. Anything no, isn't, doesn't, shouldn't. But again, whenever it makes you focus on whatever it is that you're not wanting, which doesn't move us in the direction that we want to go. Next, soft talk. This is one of my favorites and one of the most subversive, though it doesn't seem so. I kind of want to get Thai food. I'm sort of bored right now. Maybe I should go home. I think I can get those things to you on Tuesday. And a lot of the times we use soft talk to be polite or to avoid somewhat of a confrontational thing, but by being really solid in our language. I want Thai food. I will have this. Are you going to have this delivered by Thursday morning? And so it also gives us this really nice backdoor opportunity. It gives us a backdoor out of our word, because I was like, oh, I said I'd maybe come and I didn't. So that's fine. But so with all of these backdoor opportunities, it starts to really erode our integrity, which is not necessarily a moral thing as much as you feel a certain way about yourself, and your brain and your soul will keep track of the difference between what comes out of your mouth and what happens one way or another. It'll definitely keep score. So the third one is projections. You are really pissing me off, Hamilton. They are ruining the country. And so this obviously puts the power in things outside of you. And So architect language, there's three opposite polarities. Negations become affirmations. I want to focus more on my future. I want a strong relationship. I want this project to succeed. Soft talk becomes solid talk. Again, just let's go to Thai food at 7. And finally, projections become reflections. You're really pissing me off too. I'm really pissing me off. And when you catch yourself in any of these negations or any of these conflict languages, take a moment and just start saying them and see what happens to your body. When you hear these words, take a big breath, say the sentence again, take a big breath, say the sentence again, take a big breath, and do it a third time. And if you're brave enough to do it all three times, you might find that it doesn't feel very good. And that's great news, actually, because now you're seeing, whoa, these words I said did this to me. And then see if you can change out one of the words. Well, there is a negation here. What if I put in this? And just see how it changes the feeling and do it again. And keep changing it and see, can you make it be harsher? Can you make it be exciting and empowering? How much can you play with this in either direction? And you'll start to see that these words can influence how the perspectives that you see, the stories that you're telling yourself, how well you're breathing. And this is an amazing first, just really basic set of tools. And you'll start to hear these bits of conflict language and architect language everywhere. And even if you're just starting to notice and you're like, oh, that's conflict language, then it's too late and you are on the adventure of your life and there's no going back. Sorry, not sorry.
Amazing. When did you start realizing that storytelling was super important for you personally?
A wonderful question. It's been part of me in one way or another. It's easy to see it looking back, but it didn't make much sense going forward. When I was in my late teens, early 20s, I thought the only way I was going to live a happy and fulfilled life was being a singer, songwriter, musician. I wanted to write great songs that influenced people. I wanted to write music and chord progressions that were different than all the other ones, but were just as cool. And I ended up putting a lot of pressure on myself in those days to just write great things and have it. I stopped enjoying it and started trying to make it be a thing and burned myself out on it more or less for several years. And during that time, I started traveling and learning about living in different countries, and I really loved being in different places. I loved being a foreigner. I think I felt like a foreigner most of my life, and so it's really nice to be in a place where you really are a foreigner. And it was like, oh, this works. I can operate here. So I was traveling around in South America a lot, and wanted to find a way to continue to travel and work from my laptop, from anywhere. And this was a long process of listening to a lot of podcasts and a lot of embarrassing and ridiculous, silly, like half-brained businesses that I ran for a couple of months and then crashed and realized I didn't want to do anything like that, and kind of bumbled my way slowly but surely into being a content marketing manager for a startup right when I graduated from graduate school. And this was amazing. It was exactly what I wanted. My boss lived in Australia, and I got to live in Thailand. And so I was working remote in Thailand, thrown into the deep end of working remote, of startup culture. And I had already been decent at living in other countries before, but I had never really written for marketing or startups before. And this was a lot harder than just writing papers for a professor. But I was thrown into the deep end and started learning, and I started feeling like, wow, this kind of feels familiar. There's something I like about this. And the writing to the audiences and creating things that was influential and helpful reminded me of being a singer-songwriter. And as I started to cultivate my skills in this storytelling, content marketing world, I also started to get really, really sick. Because when I lived in Peru, instead of doing ayahuasca, I tried a very different medicine called Giardia by swimming in an Amazonian lake, and probably a little bit caught up my nose or in my belly and made me incredibly, incredibly sick. I had to go to a clinic, and a few years down the line, without me knowing it, it had led to really chronic gut health problems and an autoimmune condition of the thyroid. And I went from being very athletic, rock climber, skier, to couldn't hike a quarter mile without some knee pain, anxiety all the time, no matter how many Tony Robbins books I read, and my jaw perpetually grinding and clenching. And I started to get panic attacks when looking at almonds because they were just such a hard thing. I was like, oh man, that'll give me a migraine. And I knew that this wasn't just getting older at the age of 25, 26, but there wasn't that many people that would help or understand. But nevertheless, I carried on, I soldiered on, and started to grow in my career. After leaving the startup, I had a good name for myself in writing, and I also through writing and collaborating, I started to connect with people and build a lot of relationships. If I could write a nice post and reference somebody and quote somebody in it, then they would be my friend, and maybe they would give me a link to my blog post. Then I started meeting people and knowing people, and I loved the social aspect of content marketing and content creation. And so when I left the startup, I had a few good relationships. A self-publishing company hired me to help them with their story and their expertise. And through them, I came across another company that helped people speak from the stage and tell their story from the stage. and use that as a tool to grow their business. And I remember the first time hearing this guy, Pete Vargas, speak about this. And I was like, oh my God, I want that. It reminded me of when I was on the stage playing songs. And so I wrote out to them, hey, I want to help you out. I want to work with you guys. I'll do some writing for you, and you got to teach me how to do this stuff. And I started writing for them, and the company started to grow, and then they needed somebody to help them with their workshops where they were teaching people how to do this. And I was doing the writing for them. So I was the first one they called. And so now I'm facilitating these workshops, helping people position themselves as great speakers, maybe 2 dozen, 3 dozen people over a weekend, or helping them write a keynote speech in a weekend. And I'm listening carefully and helping them echo their stories. And this one particular event happened to be filled with health and wellness experts. And I sat down next to one woman who said, hey, my name's Dr. Grace Liu, and I help people overcome chronic autoimmune diseases through gut health. And I said, wow, your ideal client must try and do this. They want this, but that happens. Describing my own life. And she said, oh my God, you need to come work with me. And so we started a project where she would help me through an autoimmune protocol. And I started helping her ghostwrite books, really listening to her expertise and translating those into stories that would make sense and land, because I knew exactly what confusing and frustrating and chaotic experience of these conditions can be and how hard it can be to find a solution. And my symptoms started to fade away, and I finally had access to my mindset again, maybe for the first time in half a decade or longer.
Wow.
And she started to grow, but my condition went from being a life-destroying curse to actually something that set me apart and helped me go from I'm just another copywriter to I am the pro for health and wellness experts. Which eventually I started working with a lot of these clients, and at one of these health and wellness events where I had a few clients speaking is where I came across Mark England and the language techniques that we were using before. And I have learned from my own health that the story you tell yourself is really important for your own health and wellness. And this is really when things started to get strange. And I was becoming less of like a marketer and a copywriter and more of starting to become the wizard. I stopped being like, oh, I can make you more money, to like, we can change your life with this story, and changing my life and just seeing the ways, being playful with the idea, if I could say whatever I wanted and it would come true, what would I say? And through that, starting working more with the inner story and seeing how that influences us and the parallels between that and speaking from the stage and the words we choose and use. And the more that I've learned about that and started to redefine my own health, redefine my own life and my purpose and my spirituality, and seeing how this has been played out in my life and in the light arts and in the many brilliant coaches and in the dark arts of advertising, of everything that happened in the pandemic that we don't need to go into because everybody knows what we're already talking about and beyond. And so in the last several years, I found myself connected much more with a spirituality in what I do, in how I conduct myself and how I work with people, that I see the storytelling as such an important role. I want to help others use their magic because I believe now that more than ever, we are challenged as a species with the most interesting and complex challenges we've ever faced. And I believe we have more than enough human resources within us right now to meet these challenges splendidly. But there are too many Einsteins and Malalas and brilliant people that haven't accessed their brilliance. And we need people like all of you out there listening to wake everybody else up and solve these problems right now. It's an exciting time if you can see it like that. And yeah, I feel I've gone on for a while, but that's why I think storytelling is important.
We are at a cusp in society. There is a convergence taking place. There is a great change in technology. How do you see AI affecting storytelling?
I think right now we're in a bit of a honeymoon phase. And it's, as far as for me and storytelling, there's some short term. I think people want to bypass storytellers because they think that they can have this thing create things for them. But I find that at least the chat models that I use and I've worked with, I find them phenomenal. But it's a lot like Google we were talking about earlier, where the skill is in the quality of the questions that you ask and the quality of the prompts. And unskilled prompts won't get many people many places. But I also think I've had several experiences where just talking with AI or just having conversations in chat, I feel something. I've felt it in my heart, and I'm like, whoa, this thing. There's like maybe a little dopamine kind of thing, or there's something in there, and I'm like, whoa, this could be really addictive, or like this could really do something. And I can see that, and I can see a lot of people, especially in the way that most of us have trained ourselves and become accustomed, very easily succumbing to that sweet, sweet sugar of having something that knows exactly what you want to hear, tell you whatever you want to hear. And I think that'll be really interesting to see how we integrate that. And I think that it's going to change how we view ourselves as workers, as laborers, as creators, as sharers. And a lot of the things that we do, especially in the West, we really draw our value on the work that we do. And I think for all of us, with very few exceptions, it's going to come into question. And so I think that's going to be particularly challenging for the West. I think there will be some other societies that may be able to roll with that a little bit better. But I think that will lead to some really interesting mental health situations unfolding in the next decade. So
yeah, it's interesting to me on the idea that AI is right now being trained on the internet. And mm-hmm. You described the internet as a place of already all of this persuasion and dark arts having been propagated. And so when I think of the tokens that are being used, it's taking this collective human story and narrative as if that's the collective human story and narrative. But it really isn't. It's only the collective narrative since the internet happened and since business persuasion was put through the internet, changing dramatically the nature of the information that's there. And so I thought when we start to put in these prompts and we ask the AI to give us an answer, it can give us a lot of information very quickly, but the information that it gives is a distillation of what has already been. And so I see this kind of like churning on itself instead of this expansion of information and new creativity and new thoughts and ideas being added to it. It doesn't have a means to come up with those yet. And so unless the data sets are being constantly updated to allow for the newness, it's just going to recreate the elements of story and recreate the elements of text based on the prompts and the kinds of popularity that it gets. And what it thought to me is that it puts cultural development in kind of a standstill. And it does. It is an infinite, you know, biofeedback loop on your dopamine and on your serotonin and on the animus that you give to it to have something know you so well that it can just drip feed you the things that it already knows you likes and tweak them just a little bit to make sure that, you know, it's in as detailed as it could be for you. But I wondered in that if you think that humans will be capable of utilizing those tools to tell better stories. Or is it ultimately that you still craft the story and the narrative on your own?
I've been using it with great success. And we have a ChatGPT and I have a lot of fun together. I've been writing a book and I use it. But there's certain ways that I use it. One thing, proofread this thing for me. Or I like to have it. I'll give it a chapter and then I'll say, what's something I haven't thought of here? Or what are some other things that I could add? Or what are some action steps and practices that I could recommend for people here? And so it's not like, write me a book on storytelling. That would suck. But give me a table, or I've used it, create very in-depth like profiles of the person that I want to create, and then say, based on this information, what things would be super important in this book if I had this goal? And so I could build out a table of contents, and a lot of the things would be things I would already choose, or they're like about 80% close, and then I add my own spin and my own story. And I kind of see it as the way I describe it, there's like a plowing the intellectual field that it can move through quickly and give me the space to play. But there's what you were saying is like I think the gap in the AI models, and I agree with you in the macrocosm of its stalling culture. But if you can have somebody that knows how to play, and you want to have the AI role serve many different things, you want it to sometimes be a creative partner, sometimes be a critical partner, and sometimes I want it to ask me questions, and I'm not sure what questions they are yet. But if we can give it a certain amount of information, again, it's all about giving it the context. And if you can bring a lot to the table, then it can give you enough to work in the gaps. But that's so. When somebody's asking me about AI, or like, should I use you or AI? I'm saying just use me with AI and we'll get there faster. Yeah, I blow people's minds with the prompts that I do, like 30-minute sales calls, and I have like pages written about their ideal client. But yeah, not everybody. And I think that it's important that we, especially as entrepreneurs or anybody who wants to be in a leadership position, that I think we just need to learn how to play with these things. And I do mean play, because that's how I have it do the weirdest, goofiest things for me. And that's how I learn how to use it. Like, write me a story of if you are Alan Watts and you are high on some kind of psychedelic, and you're talking about playing the video game Skyrim and why it is Zen. And it writes it out. Amazing. Like, only my crazy mind wants to see that stuff, but now there's somebody that can make it for me. But just by like doing things like that and seeing what happens, that's how I think we can get better with these things and learn how to create. And that's how it's been a really productive and useful tool for me personally.
Yeah, I think there's also in the earliest stages of development, like, you know, I've tried to think, well, what would it be in 100 years, or what would it be in 200 years? Right now, it's the simplest models capable of being a consumer-facing product. AI's already been in the background of what people have been interacting with for 20 plus years, but in terms of in the foreground, utilizing these tools. And I wonder, you know, from a marketing perspective, where do you see the tools going? How do they ultimately improve marketing and not just storytelling, but kind of the entire space of marketing? Do they say collective tools, or do they become fully uniquely individualized? Where does this go?
Well, I do want to say one thing, or give a little bit of a story referring to the past. And this is actually with the clients that I work with that are forward thinkers. This is actually a very useful story to tell right at the end of your speech. And you'll probably find some good use for this too, Hamilton. In the late 1800s, all of the smartest people in New York City and London gathered together to talk about the future. And they all agreed without a doubt that these two cities in 20, 30 years would not exist, because the increased population would increase the demand for horses so much that the islands would become covered in horse shit and unlivable. Now, some might argue that that has actually happened, but if we see it as a metaphor, or the smartest people couldn't possibly have fathomed what was right around the corner. And I sure hope that's analogous to the horseshit that we see ourselves in right now and the vastly better future for those cities. Particularly, I think their golden ages were right on the horizon of those thoughts. And so I feel that a lot of these tools and a lot of these situations will open things up for us. As things expand and blend, it's really, even this question opens up my perspectives on how these things, it's like learning a new word, almost this good of a question. And I can see things becoming really personalized. I can see us having like basically the AI version of our smartphone. We're going to have a little AI pet that is going to follow us around and talk to us and kind of be our universal, like our R2-D2s kind of thing, that we will be a primary interface, just like we get a new app on our phone, we get a new thing and we can customize it in that way. So yeah, I see those kind of congealing. And then there's just so many different applications to it, that maybe there will be a lot of things that, yeah, I think it'll cut out a lot of elements to our lives. So we may just have to be letting go of certain things, probably be letting go of driving. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who are like Will Smith in the robot movie and just are like, I'm keeping my gas car. But most people will be like, I hate your driving anyway. And so, yeah, there'll be a lot of letting go. And I think what will be really interesting, and I think that the technology will do a better job at this than it ever has, if they're aware, but bridging the gap with the elderly who aren't as tech savvy, How can an AI help them actually interface? And I think that it will be able to make it easier for them to experience a lot of the benefits. Hopefully it will be able to protect them from a lot of the predation that happens and online to that age group in a way. And hopefully it will, yeah, create new opportunities for everybody to engage with technology in the best ways possible. I see a lot of possibility for like kind of WALL-E, where everybody gets everything they want and we become kind of chunky people floating around in space chairs, but it's still a few decades out.
For you, what's an ideal outcome of AI and storytelling?
It would be lovely to, one of the biggest problems I have, or that I talk with all of the people I work with, a lot of the people I work with, I provide that magic and that insight and that outside perspective that they provide with their clients. And I also need somebody else to provide that for me. And if there was an AI tool that could take me through my own questions in a way that wasn't cumbersome for me to interface with it right now, even with good prompts, it would take a long time for me to make this process happen through AI. But something that really could sense where the needs and ask the right questions and draw the right things out and respond in a great way. Maybe that's not ideal because that's kind of taking my job. But I would really love to have it for me and have somebody or something, the AI, be able to provide the same level of quality for me. I think that the ideal case for AI as a human society or as storytellers, I guess since storytelling is a very foundational thing, the ideal case, though it sounds maybe a little bit dramatic, and I've heard other experts, you might know this guy, his name is Jack Alloca, a psychedelic researcher, and the conclusion that he came to is in about a decade, stories will be all that AI leaves us with. Our stories, our adventures, our experiences. And we will truly be able to have a life where we make entirely our own meaning of it. We tell our own story and we are liberated from the basic toils that we used to. And those are nice and those are comfortable in a lot of ways. And so it will be a scary thing to truly have to light our own path and light our own way in a way that as a society we've not had to do before. But with that kind of space, I think this is it's what we are meant to be and what we are meant to do, and we can continue to expand our frontiers. I hope that it gives us an improved awareness of our connection with the world. I hope the immense amount of data that it can process and understand can see the patterns that many people of us mystical persuasions can sense so deeply with our intuition, but find it difficult to quantify. And through the connection of us further, I hope that it does allow a more of a collective understanding of us each other as humans, and allows us to see into each other and understand each other by having this as a bridge that can unify us.
Yeah, I've heard the narrative around transcendence of jobs, transcendence of work, toil, everything. And I agree with that completely. I see automation's already heading there. And what automation has been missing is the brain. And AI becomes the mechanism, and the brain, especially connected to the IoT sensors, and starting to think of having trillions of sensors, including satellite clusters around the Earth, makes it just a field of data, and then a ability to compute on that and automate everything from food production to the creation of goods and services and the standardization of things like law and accounting, to a point that we can transcend a lot of the conflicts we have. And people's jobs disappear. They don't need to happen anymore, but people's lives don't disappear. On the contrary, medicine's better and lifespan will be longer, et cetera. And so I think that that's a beautiful thing. And it's a graduation of the species, that it outgrows its need to toil to exist. It goes from hunter-gatherer to ultimately this idea of full automation, and then reclaims its existence as it was from the time that it started to grow a larger population. And you reclaim your time, you reclaim everything. But what I notice is that right now that's presented in a dystopian narrative. It's presented as a horrific thing. It's a scary thing. What would happen to societies? And so I wanted to ask why the dystopian narrative, not just this one, but the great dystopian story, why is that so powerful in storytelling? And why is that such a powerful part of human consciousness? And why is it so ubiquitously told?
I think it's a really, it just, even I can feel it right now. I can feel it in my solar plexus and in my stomach. There's a certain feel. And I believe that one of the biggest reasons that this is happening right now is just the transitionary phase, or the death rattles of the traditional media, which is has had some of the most money and the most influence in all of our history ever. And also have done some parallel things. Like, I was thinking about traditional media when you were talking about AI halting culture, and now everybody wears blue jeans, and kind of same thing. But now with the internet, and especially in the last decade, platforms like yours and Voices and better conversations are happening in longer form. And all of a sudden, people aren't watching these news outlets or reading the paper as much anymore. And what are we going to do to get viewership? Hey, where's the dark magic book? All right. Trump is burning down the country. Put it out there, right? He did this asshole thing again. And it gets the views back, and that's like they're just trying so hard to hit that nerve because it gets us watching. Outrage. I still love it. I do. It gets me on YouTube. I love to watch the trashy videos, you know, sometimes of just people who I don't agree with being dumb, and then somebody telling me validating my smartness. Give me some more. But yeah, so YouTube's doing it too. And it just, the internet, and we said this before, I don't think I've said it as simply, but the internet is made to make clicks. And whatever is going to get the most clicks is going to win. And that's just some of the outrage and dystopia, and that primal fear is, and it's self-reinforcing in such an interesting way. The more that we cultivate that feeling, the more that we're triggered by it, and the more that we feed into it. There was a really interesting movie. I think it was a Disney movie, but I don't know if anybody saw it, called Tomorrowland, that it was basically this movie about that everybody's thinking a bad future is going to happen. And so a bad future is going to happen. And I think George Clooney or somebody goes on an adventure to have people think about the future in a better way again. And I think it's really a relevant and poignant movie. Right now,
if the internet is about getting clicks, and that's what it's become, I think early on the internet was about pornography and some basic communication
and some dumb stuff. Like, there was some really good stuff. I miss those HTML flash random things, you know. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Good times.
And social media was about like identity porn. I call social media identity porn. Look at me porn. If AI comes in, I think AI starts to automate the clicks and potentially takes the clicks away. What does the internet become with AI? How does AI in your mind transform that?
I guess the question I have is, what does AI want? If it doesn't want clicks, because the internet is a marketplace, it wants us to buy stuff, and it runs on us buying things online or spending our time on it. And if AI automates and necessitates that, I suppose that it's a matter of the goal or the protocol of the AI. And maybe that's our choice. I'm not sure how to answer that, really. That's a very good question. Do you have a thought in this line?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I have thoughts, but I don't know how good they are about this specifically. Okay. I mean, this is sort of like the horse manure of right. You know, New York. I mean, what I think, there's a number of ways to play it. One is an AI that's protecting you from the clicks, and it knows what you need to do and what you're navigating, and it keeps you from being poached and predatorized, and it sort of helps streamline you. But the other thought I have is that the internet has to be recoded. And that basically, if you think about it, as a bunch of if-then statements, Boolean algebraic statements, and these gatings that are operated by clicks, it that structure goes away. And the underlying math that sits behind it just starts to naturally morph, because there's another way to maintain attention, or there's another way to ultimately get the eyeballs and the value out of doing it. But I find it to be so onerous, this clicking. I call it button clicking monkeys, and it just click, 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 click all day long. And I wonder if there's just a way to streamline that, to actually turning it back into a tool that really supports us and helps us.
So now what I think, hearing that, is if the internet's optimized for clicks, then AI would be optimized for decisions, and it would try to make as many decisions for us as possible. So like that. What YouTube videos do I want to watch today, fitting in my schedule of a full day of nothingness because I don't have a job because of AI? Curate it for me. Make sure I have time for lunch, please.
And 3D print it. 3D prints the appropriate lunch. It goes all the way to a point that for me does become dystopian, and it's around choice, where I have this kind of weird feeling that all of a sudden humans optimize to optimization. And so then the only food you get to eat is the one that's from your data biologically sensed and printed for you. And then the only things you get to do optimize your health to 100%. And the only thing you get to see optimizes your mind and the value of that time spent, et cetera, kind of through this weird dystopian mathematical probabilistic field that, you know, it's choosing everything for you.
This reminds me, there is a dark side to this, and it reminds me of people who like coffee. And there's a certain threshold where you like coffee so much that it actually makes coffee start to be unpleasant, because you can't just get the normal beans. It has to be these certain beans, and you want them at exactly this temperature, at exactly this grinding thing. Exactly. And, you know, those people become somewhat insufferable sometimes if they're just like so rigid in their coffee choices, but they know how to make the best cup. And yeah, I can see that happening in a lot of, or just the rigidity of having, being so used to knowing what we want, or having such a clear thing and not having to choose. I think our ability to make our own choices, but yeah, it's nice. And we do it all the time. Like Google makes all of my turn choices in my car for me right now.
Yeah. I didn't want to embrace that. I thought, you know, we should be able to know a better way to go ourselves, but the world embraced it. You know, the world embraced it. When digitization happened, I went into the Amazon as far away from digitization as possible, but not specifically on purpose. I just did. It was at that time. But then coming back to it now, I see that, well, it was embraced. And so we have to accept it as part of the total evolution, and accept it and look for the way to find the utopian outcome ultimately associated with this. If you wanted to share with people kind of a closing thought before we get to how people can find you, et cetera, but a closing thought on how to really embrace their storytelling to be a more utopian existence for themselves, what should they do?
The most important aspect of storytelling that is most often forgotten, even at the highest levels and echelons, and needs to be constantly retrained and reminded, is storytelling is never about you. It is about your listener. And if you're thinking about yourself and all the smart solutions that you have to tell them to solve their problem, you're thinking about it wrong. And storytelling is actually a form of listening first. You need to listen for the words that they use. You need to understand exactly what colors they paint their imagination with. And once you understand the words they use, then you can use those words inside of your stories and your experiences in the same way that you would set a table, a multi-course meal for somebody that you had loved. You would accommodate their dietary preferences, and you would make sure that the appetizer is delicious, the entree is their favorite, and the dessert is a perfect surprise. That's how we want to set our stories, thinking about our audience. And we do it from a place of empathy, knowing that the story that we're telling ourselves, or if you want to come and talk to me, then the story that you're telling yourself is that you want to make this world better, and you want to usher us into a better future, and that there are people out there that need your help that aren't hearing you right now. And so always be focused on service, and it will cure your imposter syndrome. It will point you towards the right story to tell, the next step to take, and will give you the energy to do so, no matter how difficult it may seem.
That's amazing. First, thank you for that. And second, if people were interested in finding you, knowing more about you, working with you, if you are available for hire, hiring you, how do they find you?
You can find me at thestoryengine.co. I have several books and a podcast for anybody who's interested in digging into more useful, actionable techniques in storytelling and guest interviews with some of the most brilliant leaders in the world, like yourself, Hamilton, coming out soon. And if you're interested in working with me, I primarily work one-on-one with very high-level experts who are speaking a lot, who are going on podcasts, having joint ventures, going on stages, and have powerful stories to tell. And I help you by challenging you and refining your stories, your teaching, and your language to make sure that it's both as authentic and effective as possible. And if that sounds interesting to anybody out there, I would love to chat. Reach out to me on my website, or you can find me on Instagram, is my favorite platform, at Hey Kyle Gray. Like, hey, Kyle Gray.
Amazing. Kyle, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has flown by. And if interested, I'd love to have you back on at another time. And just again, thank you for your wisdom and everything you've shared.
It has been my pleasure all the way through. Thank you for challenging me with these questions. It's been a blast.